Oh, this morning, I think I'd just like to offer some comments on a koan that's in our collection. The koan is a woman comes out of samadhi. So the title of this talk is, Why Does a Woman Come Out of Samadhi? And we'll take a look at that. First of all, I'll read the koan, and this is a very old story that's based in Indian mythology, made its way into the famous koan collection, the Mumun Kwan, case number 42. Long ago, Manjushri went to a gathering of all the Buddhas. Everyone returned to their seats, but one woman remained seated near Shakyamuni, deep in samadhi. Manjushri asked the Buddha, Why may this woman sit so near to you and I cannot? Buddha told him, Wake her up from samadhi and ask her yourself. Manjushri then walked around the woman three times and snapped his fingers. Then he put her in the palm of his hand, transported her to heaven, and used transcendent energy in an attempt to awaken her, but he could not awaken her. The Buddha then said, Even if 100 Manjushris appeared, they also would not be able to awaken her. Far down below is the Bodhisattva of delusive wisdom. He will be able to wake her from samadhi. Immediately, the Bodhisattva emerged from the earth and bowed to Buddha, who then gave him the command to awaken the woman. He walked in front of the woman and snapped his fingers only once. At this, the woman woke from samadhi and stood up from her seat and bowed. So this is one of just a handful of koans in our collection. It have a bit of drama to it, has a bit of drama to it. It's a full-blown storyline involving twists and turns, a contested seating plan, family jealousies, magic shows, and a surprise ending. The setting for this little drama is the Dharma Room. And we can look at that as being metaphor for our living quarters, wherever that may be, in whatever context that may be. And, just on to take a minute and talk about this seating plan, I'm reminded right away of my experience of this drama being played out constantly in the early days of quantum school when I lived at the Providence Zen Center. Anytime there was a ceremony or a special occasion, a lot of people would come. And the seating plan was very particular. Sung-san sits in the middle, and then everyone sits next to him and further away according to their rank. So this is kind of interesting. It's based on the Buddha's radical reinterpretation of hierarchy. Whereas formerly, hierarchy would be according to age and status. What the Buddha tried to do to mitigate those entrenched habits was to have a seating arrangement based on when people took precepts. And we've followed that ever since. However, there's this little problem there, which is women were not figured into this at all. So fast forward 1,000+ years later, Sung-san in coming, Zen Master Sung-san in coming to the West really tried to include women as much as he could in his own era and with his karmic baggage. So, you know, he was one of the first to authorize a woman teacher, Bobby Rhodes. Some of you know her. And yet, because he came from a very strict Korean culture, whenever there was a ceremony, a lot of Koreans would come and they could not abide Bobby Rhodes, a woman, sitting so close to Sung-san. So he had to fudge it, and he would put her husband in front of her, even though he didn't have her, you know, her status as a teacher. So things like that were all happening all the time. Years later, just a little anecdote, 20 years later, I think, roughly, I went to visit the Cambridge Zen Center. I don't remember why, what I was doing over there at that time, but there happened to be a retreat going on at the Cambridge Zen Center, and so I thought I would attend. And, you know, it was a spur of the moment thing, and Bobby Rhodes was leading the retreat. And, you know, we hadn't seen each other in so many years, and, you know, we hugged, we talked, and she said, "You should sit next to me." "You should sit next to me." And I said, "Oh, okay." But then along comes this nun who is used to sitting there, and she showed up late for practice, and she was all upset. "What was I doing sitting next to Bobby Rhodes? And that is not my correct position." So it was embarrassing and awkward and difficult. So I just immediately got up and went and sat somewhere else. Anyway, seating arrangements. One of the things that I enjoy about Zoom, that's kind of a surprise manifestation of online practice, is that we're all sitting next to the Buddha. We're all sitting next to the head Dharma teacher, right? Isn't that the way it shows up? And that's pretty cool. And the rest is all, who knows, it's a mix up. But I kind of like that, the seating arrangement that Zoom has. anyway, one more just brief aside about seating arrangements. And this is, really about the politics of where we place ourselves. My husband, who's from mainland China, told me years ago that, you know, because the news is controlled, because everything, information is controlled in a communist country, people would look at the seating arrangements and any news photos. Who's sitting next to the big guy? And that would convey more information than any stylized, manufactured news that was created. So the drama is the Dharma room, you know, which is a metaphor for the living quarters that we all live in. What about the players of this drama? We have two bodhisattvas, a Buddha, and an unnamed woman. First of all, a word about bodhisattvas. A bodhisattva essentially has two meanings. It's an first meaning is the manifestation of an archetypal figure meant to represent some aspect of the teaching. On the other hand, it could be any one of us. As we manifest our own awakening and our own clarity, and as we engage with our lives with love and compassion. Then there's the figure of Manjushri. Manjushri is one of the most prominent of these archetypal figures. And, you know, he's often depicted with a sword, you know, someone who cuts through delusion. He's known to be a teacher of Buddhas extremely high ranking. Yeah. He's often depicted, he's always depicted as a man, just saying, often wielding a flaming sword in his right hand that represents the realization of transcendent wisdom that cuts through ignorance and duality. He's often depicted riding on a blue lion or sitting on the skin of a lion. This represents the use of wisdom to tame the mind, which is compared to riding or subduing a fierce lion. He was considered to be one of the most important, he is considered to be one of the most important figures of Buddhism. As an allegorical figure, we can look at one way of looking at Manjushri is that he can be understood to represent the absolute world, the absolute realm. As we say in our Zen circle, pointed 180 degrees before thinking mind. But as we have been taught, this 180 point on the Zen circle, this emptiness realm or before thinking realm, has two sides to it. One side is the side that embodies that in a Zen shout, in a cut, hitting the floor, some sound, some action. And the other side of that is absolute stillness, which is the place that this woman is occupying, by the way. So both of them actually are occupying the same seat. It's something to consider. So a point that can be made about this absolute world, that it's like zero. So why is it that Manjushri cannot awaken this woman? It's like a zero. If you add zero to 10, you still get 10. If you multiply the greatest number imaginable by zero, well, zero sort of nixes one's ability to do anything. So that's not the end point of our practice. That is why Manjushri, great as he is, cannot awaken the woman. I came across this commentary by a Zen teacher who was unnamed, but I liked his commentary so much I wanted to share it with you. His commentary was simply, Manjushri can't even ride a bicycle. And then we have this bodhisattva of delusive wisdom. Another way that this name is translated is the bodhisattva of ensnared light, which I kind of like more. It's for my ear, it sounds more compassionate and it has some more poetic appeal, I suppose. Ensnared light. So this is a bodhisattva that lives, the way he's described is as someone who lives many levels below the earth. I think personally, I would say he is the salt of the earth. He's Joe Blow. He's an ordinary being. I looked for a while online to see if I could find any other reference to this particular bodhisattva of delusive wisdom or ensnared light. None. I could find none anywhere. And so I feel like we can give him that place. Bodhisattva of the salt of the earth. in a way, for talking about the Zen circle, this bodhisattva of ensnared light, in the incidents of this story, he represents 360 degrees. He represents the coming together of absolute and relative in one simple direct action. Continuing on with the cast of characters in this drama, we have the Buddha. We know who he is, and we know that he also represents this point of 360 degrees. And what is it that he advises Manjushri? He says, why don't you just ask her yourself? This doesn't have to be so complicated. Just ask her. Then we have this unnamed woman who could be any one of us. Any one of us. At this point in the story, you know, before the salt of the earth, Bodhisattva, awakens her, before that, she is at this 180 degree point also, again, like Manjushri, but this other side of it, that is just complete stillness. Manjushri and the woman share the same seat. The Sungsan years ago, he tried to describe, have a name or a way of describing these two different sides of before thinking mind, of stillness. One is become one like this. And that is when you have an action or a sound. And say, for example, if I clap my hands at that instant, your mind and my mind become one. So that's become one like this at 180. The other side of it is without like this. And it's a little awkward in English, but what it refers to is without anything, without any action, without any manifestation. That's complete stillness. So that's the seat that the woman is occupying. What the Manjushri ends up doing with all this sort of special effects action with the woman, we might think of it as that area of the Zen circle 270, using magic, special effects, special energy. Throughout the history of Zen, there have been many, many warnings against using or relying on special effects. And I think that what that references in our own era and our ordinary world is a caution against abuse of power. Simply that, you know? So look at what Manjushri is doing to this woman. It must be said, without her consent. I read a lot of commentaries about this Kangan, and no one talks about the woman particularly. But, you know, I think we need to draw our attention to that a little bit. What does Manjushri do? He walks around her three times. And in the what that means in Zen literature or Zen history or Chinese history, I suppose, it's a mark of disrespect. It's a mark of, you know, challenge. You walk around someone three times. It's not polite. And then he just takes her, brings her to heaven, brings her wherever. She is not responding. She is not responding. So a little aside, kudos to this woman who maintains her center She maintains her stillness within her. What interests me in the end most about this koan is how it can shed some light on how we live, how we grow, how we maintain our practice. So kudos to this woman that she doesn't respond to these special effects, the special power of Manjushri. She doesn't need to be grabbed. She doesn't need to be taken anywhere. Her center doesn't move. Her innate clarity cannot be tampered with. And so this comes to then the teaching that we can find in this koan. The angle, of course, that I would like to take on this is that this is grounded, this koan, this story, is grounded in our world as we live it now. Because ultimately, that's really the only interest that a koan would have for me, is how it has meaning for who we are now. All of the parts of this drama are played by us, all of them. Sometimes we wear a Manjushri mask, sometimes a Buddha mask, sometimes someone whose light is ensnared, sometimes the mask of a woman absorbed in samadhi. The Buddha offered very important teaching. It takes up very little space in this koan, but it's core important teaching. I'm going to just shine a little light on it, in the sense that be ordinary, be yourself, be straightforward. Ask her yourself, the Buddha advises Manjushri. And of course, this kind of drama we can recognize readily. We feel offended, we feel hurt. Do we go to the person directly that we feel some problem with? No, we go around, talk to somebody else. Well, why does she get to sit next to you and I cannot? Be direct. Be straightforward. Be natural and easy. Simple as it is, it's often the hardest thing of all to carry off, to pull off. There's a commentary on this by a 12th century Zen master, Chinese Zen master, Zhang Jing. And he had this to say about the koan. Buddha nature is a natural reality. Who says there is any other teacher? When ensnared light snapped his fingers, when the woman came out of meditation, not the slightest effort was expended. When were thoughts ever stirred? Living beings are all equal. They produce many doubts and obstacles by themselves in the course of their daily activities. In other words, something we're very familiar with, ordinary mind is then mind. Sentient beings are equal. But let's look at this. Is that really how this is represented in this koan? And how this koan might fall short of this principle of all sentient beings are equal? What about that woman? Is she, in the context of this teaching story, anything more than a prop for a problem between two male bodhisattvas? Which one of the male bodhisattvas is going to get it right? What about the woman? What about her? So, I feel that it's, sometimes there are many koans or many stories in Zen where a woman is objectified or somebody is objectified in this way. And the woman has no voice. So what I would like to propose is, well, first of all, does this woman have a voice? And is she ever even asked the question? No, she's not in this story, but we'll rectify that in a minute. Yes, she does have a voice. Yes, she does have a voice. And her first voice is that voice of stillness, of clarity, of centeredness, and all the strength and integrity that that embodies. That is a voice. But no, in the context of this koan, she's not even asked the question. As a natural bodhisattva, she is waiting and ready to answer. She is ready. And that's something that's exemplified by our meditation practice. That stillness, that resting and openness, that before thinking mind is a kind of readiness. It's not passive. It's not being shut off from anything. It's an availability and total readiness. Now, when we talk about our retreats, the Korean word for it is Yeongmin Jeonjin, to leap like a tiger while sitting. So this is that kind of readiness that this woman has. So I have a question for you. If you were the woman in samadhi, and Manjushri finally asked you, why is it that you can sit so near to the Buddha and I cannot? How would you answer? This is the piece that's missing from this koan. Somebody please ask her the question so she can, perform and be her compassion, embodied compassion and wisdom source. So, but keep this question in mind. If you were the woman in samadhi and Manjushri asked you, why is it that you can sit so near to the Buddha and I cannot? How would you answer? As it happens, I will be offering Dharma dialogues later this month. So please, if you come and it interests you, we can look at that and see what you come up with. So this comes to really my final point in this commentary, which is the central importance of posing a question. I think most of you know how much I value just what a question is. Even Manjushri, even though he's showing his jealousy, his sense of what a seating chart should look like and hierarchy, he has a question, and we need to honor that. And take it as a wonderful place to begin. When we have a question, we are opening ourselves up. Regardless of the karma that surrounds a question, whether it's clever or not, whether we're swayed by emotions or greed even, or whatever, it can serve as a crack where the light gets in. If a question is genuine, regardless of its motivation, there is a chance for insight to occur, for compassion and wisdom to respond. That is why a woman or any one of us comes out of samadhi. Questions are like gifts. Please offer them freely to others, ones that are genuine, no matter what the motivation or karma there is around it. Last night, I had some family over for dinner. My son and his fiance and my grandson, Nicola. And Nicola is a bona fide, full-ranking teenager. And he's got all the attributes of someone who's just feeling his, all his, the karmic stuff that you go through as a teenager. And, you know, he would alternate between being kind of gruffly disinterested in anything we were saying to then commenting at length about how stupid everyone is in school and how the teachers are terrible and all that. And so, you know, where I could, I asked him some questions and I could see that there was engagement then so that he could be who he is. And there could be some growth for all of us around that. And it was a lively, wonderful evening, I think in part because of the questions. Anyway, we never know. We say in our sort of general way in our Zen practice, how may I help you? But notice when you interact with others, can we really open ourselves up in a very specific way? What would help here? Are we ready to hear an answer? So anyway, I don't have any graceful or wise way to end this this commentary on the koan, but I invite all of us to look at these koans with fresh eyes and really, you know, examine what's going on here. What's missing? How can this have some relevance for who we are and how we live? So thank you for your time to listen to these words. Any questions, I would welcome them. Commentaries, quibbles.
I have a question. It's like, why was it necessary to wake her up or to move her out of the place to begin with? That was just sort of like, why didn't they just leave her alone?
yeah. But, you know, that's an interesting question. You know, Manjushri had a question and he just needed it answered one way or another. Why do you get to sit there? And I think, you know, your question, Julie, reminds me of the stories that we've read about the Buddha. Just before he became a Buddha, he sat under this Bodhi tree, attained enlightenment. He attained that place of stillness and extinction. And at first, he really didn't want to, he wasn't inclined to do anything, to leave that seat. It was so peaceful. It was so still. It was so complete. And what does he see? But there's some wandering merchants are coming into view. And he realizes that he does need to respond. He does need to engage. Yeah. But we can carry that seat. And I think this is an important point. We can carry that seat in our core, at our center.
So is this sort of like similar to like when they say like, you know, you climb the mountain, you're required to come back down to meet mm-hmm. the world. Is
mm-hmm. it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that is our bodhisattva direction. Yeah. Anything else?
Good morning.
Good morning, Desiree. Good to see you.
Hey, too. For me, I was really seeing how often I have that Manjushri energy in my life and seeing, well, what was the comparison with the other bodhisattva? And I see that often I come at someone with that kind of authoritative sort of like trying to force them into whatever, you know, and it made me see how the other one was, you know, the way to engage with that woman was this connection of kind of sameness or something, where instead of, you know, I was thinking about like oil, you know, oil and water or oil and oil or some similarity in that kind of salt of the earth place instead of this, like you said, instead of this forcing kind of thinking that I know best, that whatever, that kind of energy that that doesn't work to engage or connect with the person. So anyway, that's what
yeah.
I felt.
Oh, I think we all feel that Manjushri energy. And, you know, it's like with the at dinner last night with Nicola, my grandson, you know, all of the adults in the room can, you know, we're kind of smiling behind our hands, refraining from voicing that Manjushri sword. So, but here again, to ask, I felt like Nicola felt some sense of power and self-worth when I offer him a question. What do you think?
Yeah.
What do you think would, he went on a rant about cell phones in the school and why, you know, teachers should never confiscate cell phones. And so I asked him, well, what do you think would work? And, mm-hmm. you know, then it gives him some authority, but then it forces him to really examine. Yeah. His assumptions, doesn't it?
Right. I also have a teenager, a 19-year-old, and, you know, I can see that. And I think that is a really great reminder, not just for him, but, you know, for all of us to ask questions, to allow the person to open up. So, yeah, I appreciated that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, thank you. Thank you again for listening. And I hope you enjoy the lovely weather outside today, wherever you are.